my bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James K. Galbraith, the professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and serves as chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, and The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good to be with you.
And clearly the showdown is looming between the White House and the Congress, who have threatened, John Boehner has threatened that he will tie the debt ceiling increase to spending cuts in the name of deficit reduction. And on the other side, the White House is saying they have a new focus on job creation to reverse income inequality and restore economic opportunity for working Americans. What's going to happen with this collision, this game of chicken, do you think?
Oh, I think it will pass. I don't think anybody can really take the Republican position that seriously, in particular because all of this talk about the deficit as being a huge problem has proven to be so much smoke. The deficit has basically fallen very quickly, even with the very slow rates of economic growth that we have. So it's become, I think, a little bit embarrassing for all of those who were saying that we were becoming the next Greece and otherwise going to hell in a handbasket on account of the deficits, to find that this problem is vanishing from the news.
Well, the House is going on vacation for the month of August and coming back on September the 9th. They're going on vacation on Friday, but not before taking their 40th vote to cripple Obamacare. I mean, does the public...
How many of those had any effect on the program at all? I think the answer to that is zero.
Right.
The House can vote all it wants, and so long as the Senate doesn't go along and so long as the President doesn't sign any bills, it's an exercise in a very empty form of theater.
But it is apparently going to be sometime in September that the debt ceiling is reached, and apparently it was actually reached in May, according to the Secretary of Treasury, Jack Lew, who said that we've been using extraordinary measures since May to pay our bills. We'll do that as long as we can. Apparently, as long as we can is up until early September, when they come back from their vacation.
Well, now we could have some disruption to, I suppose, some things as a result of the games being played in the Congress. But I think any political figure that seriously threatened the full faith and credit of the United States over an effort to insist on some particular political outcome is taking their political life in their hands at this point. I don't think the American public is impressed by the threat that the United States is going to breach the debt ceiling, which, after all, was raised how many times? I've forgotten now, 17 times in the administration of the sainted Ronald Reagan. It's not it's a charade which has been played out so many times in the past that I find it very difficult to believe that anybody will panic over it this time.
But they did in 2011 go to the mat, and the president folded and came up with this sequester and this whole mechanism. And unfortunately, at the press at the time didn't speak of it in terms of it being unprecedented and reckless. They basically, because as is their way, they said, and on the one hand, on the other hand, they didn't really punish the Republicans. Maybe the American people figured it.
What happened in 2011 was the compromises and the destructive compromises that were taken because the White House was prepared to make them. And the White House now has is moving in the direction of making the argument that it shouldn't compromise on this issue, and that the political responsibility will fall entirely on the Republicans in Congress if they choose to play the same game. And I think that's a much stronger hand. At the time, the political argument in the hands of the deficit hawks of the austerity caucus was much stronger than it is now.
Well, so
at least I'm hopeful. I can't guarantee that will be the outcome. I can't say that the White House won't again turn tail on this question, but I certainly hope that they don't.
Well, at least they seem to be taking a smarter negotiating strategy. This time around, he's already saying up front now, the president, that this is non-negotiable. So to that extent, I suppose that's an improvement. But
that's a great improvement, sure.
But still, you do have this enormous gulf between what the president said last week about the economy at the side of the famous Lincoln-Douglas debate and what the Republican budget, outlines of which the New York Times printed recently, which is extraordinary. I mean, not that the Ryan budget is not a harbinger of a kind of jihad against the government itself, but the idea that you'd cut EPA by about 40%, IRS by about 30%. This is the same people, by the way, the deficit hawks cutting the IRS. Is like, are they serious? Does anybody get it? I mean, that's my worry, that people don't.
Well, I think they are serious. We are looking at an extremist movement, which is fully in the hands of, let's say, a very narrow group of interest. I mean, who wants to cut the EPA? The question answers itself. Who wants to cut the Internal Revenue Service? Again, the question answers itself. This is not a difficult matter to figure out. So if you have a political party which is making its agenda these particular points, which are of interest to very small numbers of very powerful players, but who have interests that are completely against those of the overwhelming majority of the American public. The American public, after all, does want its environment preserved. It would like to have action against climate change. It would not like to have its water poisoned and its air poisoned. It does not want the full faith and credit of the United States government sacrificed. It does not want rich people to escape from tax enforcement. I mean, these are the longstanding, very stable attitudes on the part of the American public. And the American public is just going to have to decide if that's the position the Republican Party wants to take. What conclusions do you draw? Of course, it could turn all power over to the Republican Party in the course of the next presidential cycle.
Which apparently is the way it works, isn't it, in the midterms?
You know, if that's what happens, we will have to live with the consequences. But it's a fight that I think any reasonably well-led Democratic Party should be willing to engage on those grounds, because it's an eminently winnable fight.
In talking about a well-led Democratic Party, and of course they
that I admit is a somewhat problematic proposition.
Well, I'm going to say, talk about grist for the mill, though. If they want to pick it up and run with it, the AP just published an advance indication of a study that's being done by a group of economists. That indicates that 4 out of 5 U.S. adults are struggling with joblessness and near poverty and have to rely on welfare at least for some part of its life. They've come up with a different way to look at poverty in terms of economic insecurity as a metric. And it really throws into question the whole idea of the American dream and how well we're doing and we're recovering and all this stuff. I think the AP report and this study that's coming out, I think, to my mind, that is the reality. So how do you transfer that economic reality that most Americans are in, 80% of them, who aren't doing well, into political action?
Well, I haven't seen the study, but if what it's saying is that four out of five have at some point in their lives to fall back on social insurance. It does tell you that everybody is somewhat precarious at one time or another, which I think most people know. But it also tells you that there's enormous value to having social insurance programs, and that having the capacity to support practically everybody at some point or another when they need it is an extremely valuable program, an extremely valuable, basis for a social system. And then again, we can ask, is the Democratic Party going to stand up for an insurance system on which four out of five Americans will rely at some point in their lives, whether that's Medicaid, whether that's unemployment insurance, whether that's food assistance, food stamps, whether that's, ultimately, practically everybody, of course, has some benefit from Social Security, so I don't know if that's in the study, and Medicare as well. But the point being that a comprehensive system of support that catches a great part of the population at one point or another is a good thing, and one that a great part of the population both should support and, for the most part, does support, because it recognizes people understand that there but for the grace of God go I at any given time, and that there are many, many elements. If you have a small business, or if you have a factory job, or if you have, you're working in a fast food restaurant, or any kind of working in any kind of small business, these things turn over all the time, and people do need to have the support of a social insurance network. So I think you can, again, draw a very, out of the argument made by that study, which, again, I haven't read, you could make a very strong argument for a party based upon a program of mutual support and security. And that is not the that's not the Republican part of platform. It is also then something which large parts of the Democratic Party, leadership of the Democratic Party, have been willing to compromise on, have been willing to make concessions about. One example has been this willingness to discuss changing the cost of living adjustments in Social Security so as to trim those benefits over time, which is a terrible mistake. And the Democratic Party should stand very firmly on the foundation that the social insurance framework should continue to be strengthened, and should not be making compromises with people who would weaken it.
Well, but they can't make another terrible mistake and put Larry Summers in at the Fed, can they? I mean, Obama's going to lose what's left of his progressive support.
Well, let me first of all say the president's going to do what he's going to do. I don't want to get into the personalities of who should run the Fed.
That's not my question, though.
I think it's a mistake to place too much importance on that institution. One of the things that we have, I think, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been constantly turning to Ben Bernanke to be the guy who fires up the economy, and he doesn't have the tools to do it. And I think we've seen basically that what's called quantitative easing has had some very modest effects, but it really is not adequate to the problems that we have. And constantly referring back to the Federal Reserve as the kind of policy of last resort is a terrible mistake. So if Larry Summers should become chairman of the Federal Reserve, he's going to find himself, I think, in a backwater, really, in an agency which has got certainly some importance, but is not central to the problems that we have at the moment. It's interesting as to why he actually wants the job, that, of course, is for him to answer rather than for me.
Well, but the QE2s and 2, 3, 4, or whatever, the quantitative easings, are only a symptom of the gridlock in Washington. If the president, if the Democrats could win back the House and increase their lead in the Senate.
The QEs are a device for supporting the balance sheets of the banks by replacing assets that are very problematic, many mortgage-backed securities, with cash and with assets which are basically Tier 1 capital that have very firm value, and so It does that. It may have some effect in lowering. It may have had some effect in lowering the long-term interest rates, which is good for solvent households trying to refinance their mortgages. So we can give it some credit for that. But between those two things, you were not getting very far toward a policy of refloating the whole economy. Now, the notion that there's some magic in buying back of in the buying up by the Federal Reserve of bank assets, I think it's mysterious to me as to what people thought it was going to accomplish.
Sure. Well, as I was going to say, it's all happening in the absence of any real economic progress because of the gridlock, and there's not a lot the president can do.
One function of the quantitative easing was to take some of the pressure off of the president and Congress to make concrete proposals. Oh, we have the Federal Reserve with this other policy.
Right.
Well, the other policy is basically a placebo. It's not accomplishing anything.
Right.
And it basically, as I say, removes some of the pressure on the other players.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, James Galbraith.
My pleasure, as always. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, a professor at the Lyndon Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin, and the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the inside story of who the Muslim Brotherhood are.